wish I was a mole in the ground.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Joe Clement. Patsy Kohlberg is our engineer. The Old Mole is a political magazine for your ears. We have interviews, reviews, commentary, musical selections, and all kinds of neat little goodies. On today's show, Bill Resnick and Eric Holt Jimenez talk about the politics of food farming and Eric's latest book, A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism. Denise Morris will be interviewing United Food and Commercial Workers organizer and former New Seasons worker Raina G about the current unionizing effort at New Seasons. Later in the show, I'll be joined by Jim Cook of the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association and a former union letter carrier to talk about Labor History Month happening around Portland that you can go to this month, from walking tours to music concerts and a jam session. We're going to get today's show started right away with Bill Resnick and Eric Holt Jimenez talking about the politics of food.
Eric Holt Jimenez, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Eric Holt Jimenez directs Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy. He has taught at the University of California in Berkeley and Santa Cruz, conducted graduate courses in food justice, food sovereignty, and agroecology all over the world. In his early years, he worked as an agroecologist with farmers' movements in Central America and Mexico. In this country, he still works to build movements, and he writes, including the recent book, Land Justice, Reimagining Land, Food, and Commons in the United States. His latest book is A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. It will become available to cable listeners in our next membership drive later this month, at which we will do a second part of this interview on agroecological farming that can end hunger, or greatly reduce hunger at least, produce nutritious food, and become net zero in greenhouse gas emissions. That's through, of course, replacing the current industrial capitalist food production system. Today we're going to discuss the vast damage that capitalist industrial agriculture is doing to us and the planet, and then introduce you briefly to agroecology. So, Eric Holt Jimenez, in your new book, you show how our industrial food system is killing us. Many are dying of starvation. Although the world, of course, produces ample amounts of food, several billion humans, more than the food industry, is ready to admit that the very poor can't afford. Others are dying of obesity, lured into eating large amounts of cheap, non-nourishing, but profitable food. And others are dying, the planet is dying, because industrial food production, it's one of the major sources of greenhouse gas emissions. So, Eric, let's start with the food industry claims that starvation has been greatly reduced over the past generation, and that it can be near eliminated if the governments of the world increase support for industrial agriculture. What do you make of those claims?
Yeah, well, no, thanks for that question, because those claims are based primarily on the assumption that hunger is the result of scarcity, that people go hungry because there's not enough food. And actually, if we use political economy to look at how the capitalist food system really works, what we find is exactly the opposite, that hunger is the result of overproduction. Now, what do I mean by that? So 40 years ago, when Frances Morvapay wrote Diet for a Small Planet, she's our founder of Food First, by the way, she noticed that 1 in 7 people were going hungry, even though the world produced 1.5 times more than enough food for every man, woman, and child. So she was able to determine that hunger was not the result of scarcity. It was the result of poverty because people were too poor to buy the food that was being produced. That's also the case today. Flash forward over 40 years, and at least 1 in 7 are going hungry, depending on the measure, and we still produce 1.5 times more than enough food to feed every man, woman, and child on the planet. So then one has to ask, well, who's going hungry? And it turns out farmers are going hungry. Farmers are going hungry, and the people who work in the food industry are going hungry. It turns out that farmers, small farmers, peasant farmers, actually produce 70% of the world's food.
That's amazing.
But they have to sell that food, you know, because they're poor. They sell it right away after the harvest when the prices are low. Then they don't get to keep enough of it. And sure enough, several months later, when prices are high and they run out of their own food, then they have to start buying food, and that's when they go hungry. the other thing to realize is that most of those farmers are women. Women produce most of the world's food, and yet women and girls make up most of the world's hungry. So actually, people don't go hungry because of a lack of food. People go hungry because of injustice. The farmers who are going hungry don't have enough land.
Yeah, the farmers and their children.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the farmers are...
Farm families going hungry. They're hungry because they don't have enough land. Why don't they have enough land? And the reason is because industrial agriculture, agribusiness, has pushed them off their land or pushed them up onto the hillsides into fragile areas and whatnot to occupy the best land. And that was the essence of the Green Revolution in the 1970s. You know, the original claim was that the Green Revolution saved a billion people from hunger. Well, you know, they didn't actually ever really measure that. They just measured the extra amount of food that was produced and then did the division and decided, oh, well, that looks like enough food to feed a billion people. But what they didn't realize was that the Green Revolution dispossessed so many small farmers and impoverished them that the Green Revolution actually probably produced as many hungry people as they claim to have saved. And that's back in the 70s. The same thing is happening today.
And the industrial agriculture, of course, is being used to produce often soybeans and corn that's fed to cows, poultry, fish farms, and all the rest for rich people to buy.
Well, that's the case certainly today. The huge industrial soy and livestock complex. We talk about increasing production, and it's mostly not for food at all. It's for feed, or it's for fuel. So the new genetically engineered seeds from Monsanto and Syngenta and DuPont and whatnot, they claim that they can save the world from hunger because of this improved technology. When you scratch below the surface, you see that, in fact, none of these seeds are for food. For 20 years, they tell us they're going to save the world from hunger, but instead, they've been producing soy and corn for feed and fuel. And poor people can't afford to buy the meat. And so, essentially, GMOs don't feed the poor at all. They feed people who are already well off. Or they feed our cars, which, of course, we really don't need to be growing fuel for cars. It's incredibly inefficient. Yeah. So those claims are patently false, but they follow a very simple logic that people are hungry because of scarcity. That lie is repeated over and over and over again, and we have to ask why. And that's where you have to realize that we have a capitalist food system, and capitalism always has to expand. It must expand or it dies. And so in order to be able to continue to expand, they have to repeat the lie that we need their products, which of course we don't. What they're really after, they're after that market that small farmers around the world have. That's 70% of food, which is being produced by small farmers and peasant farmers around the world. Big industrial food complex wants that market. And so they've got to basically portray themselves as saviors to the very problem which they created.
This is KBOO Radio, the Old Mole Variety Hour. Bill Resnick here interviewing Eric Holt Jimenez. Eric Holt Jimenez directs Food First, the Institute for Food and Development Policy. We're discussing how industrial agriculture is actually creating hunger and undermining this planet's climate system. We've just discussed how, contrary to their claims, while capitalist industrial agriculture is producing more food, it is also producing more hunger and malnutrition, though, of course, it does produce more product. Eric, in addition to saving the earth from hunger, saving the planet's people from hunger, the industrial food industry also claims to be the climate savior, that they can and will, if, of course, they get the right subsidies and regulations, reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Their plan, I guess they call it intensified agriculture, climate smart agriculture. They're very good at greenwashing. They hire the most creative advertising agencies. But tell us the real story.
Well, I think you mentioned earlier that industrial agriculture, if you include the issue of land use change, produces up to 40% of the world's greenhouse gases. I mean, it also uses more than 70% of the world's fresh water. It is a highly inefficient form of production. It's only efficient in terms of the market, but it's very inefficient in terms of resource use. And it's very inefficient in that it creates a whole slew of externalities, both externalities like greenhouse gas emissions, and then, of course, it poisoning not only of agricultural workers, but the poisoning of the general population with wheat laced with glyphosate. Now, these costs are usually not included in the balance sheet when they talk about the great efficiencies of industrial agriculture. So it's not surprising that now that people are beginning to take them to task for these false claims, they've come up with some new ideas like sustainable intensification and climate smart agriculture. This actually is another marketing ploy. They want to sell bigger machines, and they want to sell the services of data collection and manipulation, big data. So the idea is that satellites will collect data on the ground in farmers' fields, in big, big fields, industrial fields, and then beam down signals to the new tractors, which, of course, will be much, much bigger. And those tractors then will adjust the amount of fertilizer, pesticide, seed, whatever they need to apply. They're going to try to find some efficiencies this way. But they're still going to be growing the monocultures. They're still going to be growing the feed, which has to be shipped all over the world to the different feedlots. They're still going to be displacing the family farmers in this country and the small farmers around the world. And so I don't see any big savings regarding greenhouse gases. This is all petroleum-based. It's all going to be extensive. In order to pay for all this, they're going to have to extend into new lands. It's like saying that we need to save ourselves from overconsumption by consuming more. Remember that something like 40% of the world's industrial food goes to waste. And that's just the nature of capitalist production. Capitalist production always overproduces, so there's always all this waste. And none of this is going to change any of that. In fact, it's going to make it worse. And of course, the big question is then, what will we do with all the agrarian refugees and the climate refugees? Because if this transition into mega agribusiness actually takes place, it can potentially displace close to a third of humanity that live in the countryside. And the question is, where are they going to go? There is no new industrial revolution to sop up all this labor. The world economy would have to grow something like 15% over the next 50 years in order to absorb the labor. Well, we're never going to do that. So actually, we need other forms of production at other scales, which actually don't just reduce carbon emissions, but capture carbon. That already exists. Small farmers that practice agroecology actually capture carbon and are cooling the planet. And that's the type of agriculture that we have to support.
This is KB Radio, the Old Mole Variety Hour. Bill Resnick here interviewing Eric Holt Jimenez, who directs Food First, the Institute of Food and Development Policy. We've discussed how industrial agriculture is both creating hunger and undermining the planet's climate system. Eric, you began talking about agroecology. Give us a little bit of an introduction to agroecology. You pointed out that it could enormously reduce, in fact, go more than reduce, but capture a whole lot of, reduce the concentrations of greenhouse gas emissions in the planet. Tell us about agroecology, which is in fact working and probably now producing a substantial percentage of the world's food that small farmers eat and rural people.
Agroecology is the science and the practice of sustainable agriculture. As a science, it's over half a century old. And agroecological farmers basically work with and enhance the on-farm ecological functions. So instead of replacing those ecological functions and processes with chemical inputs, they manage them. And so these farmers use animal manures and legumes and cover crops to provide nutrients. And weeds are controlled by cultivating, cover cropping, intercropping, and mulching. And pests are managed by attracting predators with companion planting and interrupting pest cycles and vectors with crop rotation. Or they can alley crop, and they can use trap crops and repellent crops. And this is just a small sample of the many, many ways that farmers can use their own resources in order to produce a healthy crop in ways which actually capture carbon.
There's also the question of water.
Yeah, well, you know, the trick to most of this production is to have a healthy soil and to have a high level of organic matter in the soil. So agroecological farmers are always incorporating organic matter into the soil, and what that does is it turns the soil into a big sponge, and that they can capture and retain and conserve water, and they greatly reduce their water budgets. So it's important not just in terms of the climate, it's also important in terms of our aquifers, and it's important because it helps to keep people on the land. These are knowledge-intensive systems, tend to be much smaller and employ more people. And that's exactly what we need moving forward.
Yeah, and it also doesn't destroy all the streams and rivers and even the oceans close to land that our industrial agriculture is doing.
We would be able to clean up the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico very quickly if we converted to agroecology.
Eric Holt Jimenez, his book is...
The book is A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. And you can find it by going to www.foodfirst.org.
Thanks a lot for talking to us today, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Joe Clement. That was Miriam McKibba. And before that was Bill Resnick and Eric Holt Jimenez talking about the politics of food in his book, A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism. Well, up next, you may have heard that New Seasons workers are organizing, a union that is. We have a UFCW organizer talking with the Old Mole's Denise Morris about that effort. Denise?
Thank you, Joe, and thank you, Raina G, for joining me this morning.
Yeah,
I'm happy to have you here. This is really awesome because essentially the cat is out of the bag now. I'm going to have you talk about that.
The cat is out of the reusable shopping bag.
The reusable shopping bag, because we're still going to try to save the planet after all is said and done. But you're organizing with a campaign with UFCW, and that's Local 555.
Mm-hmm.
You're a former New Seasons worker, and as well, I am also a former New Seasons worker, and both of us no longer, but we are part of that community even still. I do shop there when I can afford to these days, but just went there this morning, grabbed a bagel, talked to a couple people I know and love there, and but now we're going to talk about the meat of the subject, which is not what I had for breakfast, but the cat's out of the bag. So talk about this campaign. November 1st was the official launch, and there was an action, et cetera, and in between all that, we're going to fill in some blanks about why this campaign's important and why unions are important.
So November 1st, like you said, was our public launch day. The night before, Oregon Live put out an article, the first of a couple that they ran for us in regards to the efforts that New Seasons workers have been doing in order to unionize or to start this union conversation. We started off November 1st that morning with a delegation to store support, where we delivered our statement of principles, code of conduct letter, and wanted to sit down with Wendy Colley to start negotiating and have New Seasons recognize the efforts that the workers are doing and also start meeting the workers and treating them better. The statement of principles is something that the workers have hashed out over the summer, and it touches on very key points: the ethics, dignity, and respect that workers want the company to adhere to. And when we delivered the statement of principles to store support last Wednesday, over 263 current and former workers have signed on it. And we printed it out in one long, beautiful scroll that measured 12 feet in length.
And 26 pages if you accidentally try to print the whole thing out. Just FYI.
Yeah.
But beautiful indeed.
Yeah. And then after that, we went over to the Williams store to hold a press conference. We had people from Faith and Labor in our community join us. Jobs with Justice were there and other union members were there. It was a really awesome and beautiful morning to be out there in front of the store and let workers inside the store know that we're doing this for them on their behalf as well.
One of the things that we wanted to kind of talk about is this a little bit about retail life. Both of us have been working since we were teenagers. There were no silver spoons to be found. At least I didn't find one. I mean, we both spent time working fast food and working retail, All very familiar with those jobs. And I think a lot of the mythology about retail work and fast food work is that those are not family wage adult jobs. These are jobs that are transitional for teenagers and they don't need to necessarily make a living wage. This kind of stuff is, you know, categorically not true. And some of the things that people struggle with, and the New Seasons is not exempt from this, is the desire for a living wage, but also family-friendly schedules, accountability in the workplace, safety. And the statement of principles really does capture a broad base of demands that workers want to have looked at. And safety's there, ethical business practices, equitable treatment and accountability, and dignity and respect. And one thing I find interesting, and I'll have you talk about this, is at a recent gathering, not so recent, maybe about a year ago, I went to a gathering of Burgerville workers who were beginning to organize. And one of the things that stood out to me was that this one worker said, "We love the company. We don't want to destroy it. We want to put pressure on the company to live up to its stated mission." Mm-hmm. And that is a lot about what is reflected, I think, in the campaign and the desire for workers to struggle for something that all workers want, which is more democracy in the workplace and the freedom, the real freedom to say and do some things that folks are feeling pushback on.
Sure. And that's a good segue into talking about the history of New Seasons and the culture of the company. New Seasons started in this area as the ultimate community grocery store, locally grown and operated. It still says it on their front of their stores, on their advertising, but it isn't as local and homegrown as it used to be, especially after the investment group Endeavor Capital bought it, and they control over 69% of it, give or take. Part of that culture that existed prior was really the speak up culture that the company likes to talk about, where they allowed workers to come to these coffee talk meetings where they got a chance to talk to board members and air grievances and put pressure on management to really make change. And workers felt empowered. And that was part of this idea that there didn't need to be this big organizing effort within the company because management claimed to have this really open door policy. But there was definitely things that weren't being addressed in the workplace. And so organizing efforts have been happening with this company for nearly 10 years. And that's another part of, that's important to mention, is that workers have been doing this for a long time. They have won victories across the board. Wage increases, addressed attendance policy problems, and specifically trans healthcare rights. That is because workers organized, specifically the Seven Corners store back in the day. But then, you know, the company co-opts these wins and takes credit for them. But that is that democracy in the workplace. Those are real wins that we can see that workers benefit from still. And that goes to show why there's still that importance of unions in this country. We don't have to really dig very far to see that there is that need for continued collective efforts and worker power.
And really, you know, to address something that you raised in our conversations where you're saying there have been wins, and those wins always come from below, and that's really what we advocate. Of course, we do it here on the Old Mole. We do it in our daily lives, and we are talking about workplace democracy because it's important, because workers are the community. They are the community. And one of the things that's starkly discouraging is that most people who work for New Seasons, most people who work for New Seasons can't actually live in the neighborhoods in which stores are being built. This then reflects some of the real crises in our communities. So the organizing effort, as you've said, Raina, is not an outside entity. It is us.
Oh, yeah. I think Wendy Colley said in the Oregon Business Journal and also sent out an email to the stores, her response to the organizing effort and the public launch was, this is a third party that's this entity, this outside entity that's trying to make the company look a certain way in a negative light. But then immediately thereafter, she'll say, but we're a good company because we paid B Corp to tell us so, another third company, an outside entity. The union isn't an outside entity. These are current workers, you know, and I'm an organizer, but I worked for the company for 2.5 years. We know what we're talking about. That's important to recognize, is these are hundreds of workers that are currently employed by the company that are trying to hold the company to this high standard that they claim to have and that they've promised these workers over years. And these aren't just new hires. These are people that have been with the company for 17 years that have signed on to the statement of principle. And we're really happy to have these folks on board. And it gives me goosebumps when I have these folks that are out at the actions that have been with the company for that long. It means a ton. And I'm only as good of an organizer as the workers that are on board.
Right. And you've mentioned something that I think is also important. There are lots of union workers in other grocery, conventional grocery, et cetera, in that you've said, you know, part of the process is also for the union or any union to also listen and to hear criticisms and to also strive for a greater union democracy.
Absolutely.
What do you see as some next steps? And not to give away any strategy, of course, because, you know, that's part of the fun. But what can folks hope for? I think you said there's a meeting. You asked for a meeting, and that's something that could happen sometime later this month.
Yeah, we want to sit down and negotiate with Wendy and the other higher management people at Store Support. We really want to sit down at the table meeting and hash out and be heard. This is a pro-worker campaign. We are not anti-New Seasons. We are fighting for everybody, who, even the folks that haven't signed on to the statement of principles. This is all inclusive. The people that say no, we are fighting for you too. And we can only improve through criticism. So folks that want to sit down and talk to us, that's really the democracy of this campaign. That's what's important to take away.
Mm-hmm. So big thread here, big D, democracy. Worker democracy and worker power. What's to be afraid of? Collective worker power. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll definitely talk again. Raina G. from UFCW Local 555 organizing New Seasons campaign.
Thank you workers. So much, Denise, for having me.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Joe Clement. That was Calm Truths in their latest album, Iteration. Before that, Denise Morris was talking with Raina from UFCW about the effort to organize New Seasons markets. Today, or this month rather, is Labor History Month. It has been since 1991 through the efforts of the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association. I'm joined today by Jim Cook, the vice president of PNLHA and a former union letter carrier, to talk about Labor History Month events going on around town. Thanks for coming in, Jim.
Thank you so much, Joe.
So I have read about, and you told me about, a labor tour, a walking tour in downtown, a concert, and a number of memorials that will be happening for Friends of Labor that have passed recently. Could you tell us about all those? And then we can talk a little bit about the significance of history.
Yes, the Northwest Oregon Labor Council's had a history committee since 1993 to celebrate annually November. And we do annual programs. This year we're doing a program on November 27th, which is basically an overview of this walking tour of downtown Portland. Now, there have been other labor tours, as you probably know, and others listening. In 2001, there was a labor tour in Michael Monk's Portland Red Guide. He has done working class tours. So we're basically kind of consolidating the information. We're going to different parks, starting at Waterfront Park, and we're recognizing diverse cultures.
Yeah, a few years ago, I helped a Wobbly IWW union member put on a Petalpalooza ride that toured sites of significance during the 1934 general strikes that happened along the waterfront.
Yeah, the ILW, that's an interesting history of the 1934 strike up and down the West Coast.
So we are 102 years out since Joe Hill was murdered by the government of Utah. Could you tell us how we're remembering him this year?
Traditionally, there have been concerts and every November 19th, roughly. And this year, we're holding one at the Musicians Hall. It's at 2 o'clock. Musicians Hall is 325 Northeast 20th. And we're basically commemorating his life and inspiration to all of us still, but also Portland connections. He had a number of Portland connections. Following that, we're inviting some musicians to join us for an open jam to do a lot of good labor rabble-rousing songs.
Yeah, I'm going to try and bring my banjo.
You're most welcome.
Could you say a bit more, though, about the labor history walk tour, like the scope of it? People may hear walk and say, I can't do that, but what is it really going to be like?
Well, we're still in the developmental stage. We're doing our research still. But we're starting at Waterfront Park, recognizing Native cultures and the early dock workers and maritime industry, and going through Old Town to North Park Blocks, recognizing the train stations in African-American history. We have Chinese-American history, Japanese-American history, Filipino-American. I mean, the history of this town is diverse. We're emphasizing that workers are one. And we go to North Park Blocks and then South Park Blocks, where we've had May Day and other actions. And then we go to Chapman Square, where there have been numerous free speech fights. And then back to the waterfront. Now, for some, it may be possible to carpool, bicycle to the different parks, because that's where we do our presentations.
I'm glad that you mentioned that there's going to be a bit of remembrance around Native Americans, the First Nations who are here. It is also Native American Heritage Month, and the history of labor in this country is wrapped up with a history of work that was genocidal, that was pitting humans against humans in the most gruesome way.
That's the story of capitalism.
We also have a few friends of labor who have passed recently that they're going to be memorials for. Could you speak about them?
Yes, thank you so much. I'm going to mention three names and come back to the dates. Lois Stranahan, Nellie Fox Edwards, and Norman Malbon. All enormous figures in labor in this town and region. Lois Stranahan, we're having a commemoration, celebration of her life. She passed in May. She would have been on her birthday, December 1st, at 1 o'clock at the Longshore Hall, ILW Local 8. It's on Front Avenue. That's at 1 o'clock. People who knew Lois, please join us, recognize, celebrate her life. Nellie Fox Edwards passed, and she was the first woman elected officer of the Oregon AFL-CIO. She came from Retail Clerks, which is now United Food and Commercial Workers. She passed this in October. And we lost a dear friend of many of us, Norman Malbon. He was a labor lawyer, and there aren't very many labor lawyers. There are a lot of corporate lawyers, but very few labor lawyers. And he helped this community, teaching rank-and-filers like myself labor law. And that conference is continuing. It's been going on still every January, but he passed. And that's on December 9th, 2 o'clock at the IBEW Hall, a recognition celebration of Norman Malbon's life.
We will have all of these dates and the details on our website in a day or two so that you don't have to write them down right now. But in the last few minutes that I have with you, Jim, I wanted to just ask you to talk a bit about the significance of history, of labor history, of what Utah Phillips called the long memory, and why it's important for us to remember it for psychological and spiritual as well as just informational reasons.
Obviously, there are many books that have been written, and the library, public libraries have them. Powell Books, a good union store, has them for sale, used books. You can research history. What I find is that it's inspirational. These are the true superheroes of our working class history. But where do you find the history? You have to dig for it. There are a few progressive, enlightened teachers who will bring the subjects up in their high school classes, but we know the political climate we're in is very anti-union. So they're very courageous. So I see it as an opportunity to learn myself and with others and then share this history through music, through programs. And the best vehicle for, in my opinion, is the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association. It's been around for 50 years, celebrating that next April 6th through 8th at SeaTac. You can go to www.pnlha.org for information. But it's British Columbia, Washington, and Oregon. 2019, it'll be in Oregon, the conference. It's usually in the spring. And that brings together academics, labor activists, people who want to learn more about our working class history. But it's the inspiration, the courage, the spirit that keeps us going.
I like to put in a mostly related plug for another union action also happening tomorrow. The union I belong to, AFSCME Local 88, which represents county workers in the library where I work, is currently bargaining with the county for another contract, and we're demanding a lot of very reasonable and fair things, like a wage that will keep up with housing costs and other costs of living. We're having a picket tomorrow at the Multnomah County Building down on the corner of 7th and Grand. It'll start at 12 and probably go on until 1. I'd like to thank Jim Cook again for coming on to talk to us about Labor History Month. Thank you, Jim, for coming on.
Thank you, Joe. And it points out that every day we make labor history.
For the Old Mole Variety Hour, I'm Joe Clement. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That was some more calm truths. Well, to round out today's show in recognition of Veterans Day this week, Old Mole's Denise Morris and then Jan Hawken are going to be talking about Jan's latest documentary, Mind Zone, Therapists Behind the Front Line. Denise and Jan?
Thank you, Joe. Mind Zone, Jan, is your film. It's Mind Zone, Therapists Behind the Front Lines. The film is now streaming on Amazon and iTunes, so this is another reason for us to be talking about it, because people will actually be able to see it, and it's an amazing film that digs into a subject that is sorely underlooked at and not very well understood. Let me tell folks a little bit about it. It follows members of a U.S. Army Combat Stress Control Unit as they deploy to Afghanistan to carry out two missions, protecting the psyches of soldiers on the battlefield while keeping these same soldiers in the fight. And Jan, you actually began working on this film, developing this film, in 2009, and that was following the Fort Hood incident where Major Hassan killed 13 soldiers on a military base. But essentially, your interest was more the everydayness of these stresses and the psychological impacts, and also the handling through psychology and therapy of soldiers in combat.
Yeah, and this case was interesting at the time for a couple of reasons. He was a practicing Muslim himself, experiencing enormous stress about an upcoming deployment. I ended up following over a period of close to a year through training and then deployment to Afghanistan, the unit that replaced his unit that had been scheduled to deploy. Many knew him who were part of the 113th Medical Detachment, that's a combat stress control unit. But at the time, in the left or anti-war movement, portrayed him sympathetically as this soldier who had gone off the rails under the enormity of the pressures of war and as a PTSD victim. The other side side, of course, predictably portrayed him as a Muslim fanatic, a terrorist, a psychopathic killer. He was described as someone who's not really in the military, even though the history of soldiers killing other soldiers is also a part of the military, including during the Vietnam War and previous wars. But he was seen as very much an enemy within. So I was interested in the competing psychological narratives about troubled soldiers, but also getting away from some of the narratives that came out of the Vietnam War of the soldiers coming back as walking time bombs, the psycho vet killer, or the tragic vet who has just completely fallen apart, and just kind of the everyday mental health issues in the military. And the military had been doing a lot around all these repeated deployments. I mean, during that time, mental health in war zones was part of military planning and had become very extensive. They had gone through a big campaign in the Army to destigmatize seeing mental health practitioners. And that was one reason the Army let me do this project, which was a first for them, was they were very proud of all of this mental health service, including in war zones. And I became interested in, well, is this progressive, what they called the new Army, the kinder, gentler, more nurturant Army? Is this an indication of progress, or is this obscuring other and deeper ethical problems of therapists in war zones who are still serving the mission, which was getting those soldiers back online?
One of the quotes that just resonates is from one of the more main subjects in your film, who is a major, or he's a top-ranking therapist in the military, and you kind of follow his story in the U.S. prior to his deployment and then in...
Colonel Rabb.
Yeah, Colonel Rabb, thank you. He describes it like this. He says, like a gun, you have to break it down, provide maintenance to the soldiers psychologically when there is a jam. The job is really to help soldiers clear their minds. The analogy with the gun,
the weaponizing
and the soldiers,
of the mind.
It's mind-boggling. And this is state of mind for the process of providing restorative therapy.
And of course, machine metaphors have a long history in psychology, and particularly psychologies that seem more mechanistic. But, you know, we all use metaphors that we draw from the world around us to describe more elusive processes. But I think you're also picking up on a deeper issue in terms of how the mental health practices were very much in the service of keeping the machinery of the military operating. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting to me to see how this ethical conflicts around that have been talked about since Freud. And that was another pitching point with the Army. Like, there's a military literature over a century on, can you ethically do this? Can you ethically respond to individual suffering and still serve the machinery of war, which is to get people back? And because it's very expensive to get those service members out there. And their main job is to just keep them going, keep them in the fight, maintaining the fighting forces. And that's been true for at least a century. Psychologists have been involved in that. And my appeal to the Army was, well, the public has a right to know. And this conversation, that's a very open discussion about the ethics of that in military literature.
I still kind of can't believe that you were able to do this. When people see the film, they'll realize you were in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Filming. And we want to give let's give a shout out to Caleb Heyman, who you know very well, who is your son.
Yeah.
Who was your DP on the production, and a whole host of folks who were involved in this project.
Yeah.
But to actually be there.
And it was I think, really important. There were Jeff Richards and the other camera operator came with us. We had a fairly small crew, spending so much time that year preparing for deployment, and then sometime over there when they were coming in for the handover, replacing the previous unit. I was really impressed with so many service members who also work together across race and gender lines, who have a kind of commitment to working together. Salary differences are fairly minimal in the military. You know, there was a lot that was very impressive about how people work together. I mean, if it weren't for this purpose of serving war,
sure,
and serving wars that are, in retrospect, many, if not most, would see as unjustifiable, but it really involved my coming to terms with some of my own stereotypes about the military. And for these young, my son and the other young man, I took over about the same age, you know, spending a lot of time talking with service members who were there.
These are people who are of our community. They're family members. Much of the debates that are happening now around the protests in the NFL and taking a knee and disrespecting the flag and the veterans, some of the pushback is, you know, we are those people, or those people are our family members. So we're interconnected.
Yeah,
deeply.
And there's been a lot of conflict, ambivalence, as well as active resistance against different eras of warfare. Next week on the show, there'll be a discussion of Ken Burns' recent series on Vietnam War. One problem with that series is it did not focus enough on, or at all really, on the operational side of warfare, even though it did emphasize resistance and conflict within the troops during the Vietnam War, which I think is really important to note. PTSD now is often framed as a reaction to a discrete confrontation with a threat of violence, but often the distress reactions are much more elusive and tied to sources of conflict about the war itself, often, or the mission itself. At any rate, most of the previous films, including the one documentaries, including this recent series by Ken Burns, focus almost exclusively on the infantry, on the fighters. And yet, about 80% of the service members in the Vietnam War and in these recent wars are operational. They're there to support the infantry, the fighting force, and keep those fighters going. And it's phenomenal just seeing the massive number of people that are there to support a relatively small number of actual fighters. And I was interested in those people. That's why the behind the lines has that meaning as well.
Right. And the dividing line is the wire. If you go outside the wire or
yes,
across the wire, I forget how they
yeah,
say it, but
yeah,
that's the dividing line. So behind the wire is this massive support group.
Yeah,
support
we were team in Kandahar in that forward operating base, and there are all of these outposts of small groups of soldiers. And then they'd come in for some kind of treatment or help and mm-hmm, then go out again.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot raised in the film, and I hearken back to a scene with some Vietnam vets who are actually somewhat shocked at the number of deployments that soldiers do and can't understand how in the world anyone could stay sane. For the Reader's Digest version, how do you stay sane after all of these deployments? And one thing that's raised in the film is that really, the process of getting the soldiers back into the fight is very quick. And there are quick steps. And they mention a 3-day reprieve program where you can go and rest and relax. And one guy says, 3 days?
You know, and that's as, you know, that's as old as World War I. It was called forward psychiatry. It's basically 3 hots in a cot.
Yeah.
It's kind of dressed up with some other techniques yeah, now. But the mm-hmm, idea is to comfort, to allow a kind of temporary regression, they used to call it, mm-hmm, into kind of the maternal fold of mental health, and then get them back into daddy's mm-hmm, war. But the critique of that also, I think, overlooks how limited psychology is, including in dealing with the aftermath of war. And I wanted to emphasize that point. I think overall mental health services have been oversold as an antidote to the impacts of war, either immediate or long term.
Mm-hmm. One of your psychologists involved in the ethical portion
the commentator
says the crashes have consequences. That's
yeah,
very true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a very, very long half-life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I'm glad it's available now. And I think it also is meant to apply to other places where we use psychology to try to keep people healthy in very unhealthy places.
Right. Well, thank you, Jan. Jan Hocken, director of the film Mind Zone, therapist behind The Front Lines, which is available now for streaming on Amazon and iTunes. Thank you.
Thanks.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That's all the time we have for today. I've been your host, Joe Clement. I'd like to thank our guests, Bill Resnick and Eric Holt Jimenez, talking about the politics of food, to Denise and her previous guest from UFCW, Raina G, talking about the unionization effort at New Seasons, to Jim Cook for talking about labor history events happening around Portland this month, and then again to Denise and Jan for talking about Jan's documentary, Mind Zone, therapist behind the front lines. You can listen to any segment or the whole show in a few days by going to the Old Mole's website on KBOO's website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. You can check out individual segments and get more details on each segment. Tune in next week at 9 a.m. to hear more news, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's radical perspective.